The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll be reading from the January-February issue of 2018 of Smithsonian Magazine, titled 1968, The Year That Shattered America. We'll begin with an article titled Fallen Angel by Jeff McGregor. Teen idol Frankie Lyman soared to stardom in the 1950s, but in 1968, he came crashing down. That voice, those apple cheeks, arms wide, head back, he radiates joy, even in antique black and white. That beautiful soprano flying high. Talent and presence and just enough ham to sell it. And it was a great story, too. Up from nothing. A shooting star. So when they found Frankie Lyman dead at the age of 25 one February morning in 1968, in the same apartment building where he'd grown up, it was the end of something and the beginning of something, but no one was sure. Quite sure what. Frankie Lyman and the teenagers were five kids from Washington Heights, just north of Harlem. They sang doo-wop under the streetlight on the corner of 165th and Amsterdam. They were discovered by the Valentine's lead singer, Richie Barrett, while the kids were rehearsing in an apartment house. A few months later, their first record, Why Do Fools Fall in Love, made it to the top of the national charts. It was 1956. Overnight, Frankie Lyman was the hottest singer in America, off on a world tour. He was 13 years old. That made him the first black teenage pop star, a gap-toothed, baby-faced, angel-voiced paragon of show business ambition, and a camera-ready avatar of America's new post-war youth movement. He was a founding father of rock and roll, even before his voice had changed. That voice and that style influenced two generations of rock, soul, and R&B giants. You heard his echoes everywhere. The high, clear countertenor, like something out of Renaissance church music, found its way from the Temptations to the Beach Boys to Earth, Wind, and Fire. Even Diana Ross charted a cover of Why Do Fools Fall in Love 25 years after its release. Berry Gordy may not have modeled the Jackson 5 on Frankie Lyman and the teenagers, as it is often said, but it sure sounded as if he had. That's the legend, anyway. Truth is, Frankie Lyman grew up too fast in every way imaginable. I was never a child, although I was billed in every theater and auditorium where I appeared as a child star, Lyman told Art Peters, a reporter for Ebony Magazine, in 1967. I was a man when I was 11 years old, doing everything that most men do. In the neighborhood where I lived, there was no time to be a child. There were five children in my family, and my folks had to scuffle to make ends meet. My father was a truck driver, and my mother worked as a domestic in white folks' homes. While kids my age were playing stickball and marbles, I was working in the corner grocery store carrying orders to help pay rent. A few days before Frankie and his friends from the corner recorded the song that made them famous, Rosa Parks was pulled off a bus in Montgomery, Alabama. Less than 2 years later, Frankie danced with a white girl on a national television show, and the show was swiftly canceled, another part of the legend. Race integration in pop music was never going to be simple. America in the 1950s. Post-war economy roaring, a chicken in every pot and two cars in every garage of the split-level house in Levittown. Every cliché of union-made American middle-class prosperity held to be self-evident. And music was a part of that. Raucous and brawny, electrified. It felt like Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Elvis, and Jerry Lee Lewis all fell from the sky at once. Frankie Lyman and the teenagers, with their tight, upbeat harmony, were an important part of it, too. You can trace doo-wop back to the Psalms, hear it bubble up in the a cappella harmonies of Gregorian chant, or, by the way of Africa and the Caribbean, from gospel quartets. In America, beginning in the 1930s, The Mills Brothers and the Ink Spots were the popularizers of those intricate harmonies we recognize today as proto-rock and roll. Doo-wop was among the inheritors, 1,000 street corner groups and 1,000 one-hit wonders. The Spaniels and the Five Satins and the Vocaliers, the Drifters and the Fleetwoods and the Moonglows, the Coasters and the Platters, and on to Frankie Valli and modernity. In the 1950s, every high school stairwell in this country was loud with four-part singing. Even today, the Pitch Perfect movie franchise owes its popularity to an a cappella tradition stretching back into pre-electric history. We harmonized every night on the street corner until the neighbors would call the cops to run us away, Lyman told Ebony. But Frankie wasn't doo-wop, not really. Doo-wop was group music. Frankie Lyman was always different than that. Robert Christgau, great-granddaddy of American rock critics and historians, will tell you. He was the star. Frankie and his record producers and managers soon agreed he'd be a more profitable solo act. So off he went, leaving behind the teenagers and with them friendship and loyalty. He had another lesser hit, a recording of Goody Goody, sung by Bob Crosby and Ella Fitzgerald before him, before things cooled. Then came the long, slow slide. Ask any junkie and they'll tell you what they're chasing is the feeling they got the first time they got high. But that first time rush can never be recaptured, whether you're talking about heroin or cigarettes or hit records. Frankie was a heroin addict at 15 years old. He tried to kick, tried again, and got straight for a while. And his mother died, and he fell hard. He wasn't alone. Heroin was everywhere in New York by then, and methadone clinics run by the city were springing up neighborhoods all over town. The failure rate was heartbreaking. I looked twice my age, Lyman told Ebony. I was thin as a shadow, and I didn't give a damn. My only concern was in getting relief. You know, an addict is the most pathetic creature on earth. He knows that every time he sticks a needle in his arm, he's gambling with death, and yet he's got to have it. It's like playing Russian roulette with a spike. There's always the danger that some peddler will sell him a poison batch, some garbage. Here, young Frankie knocks on wood. I was lucky. God must have been watching over me. Even now, you want to believe him. Frankie's neighborhood, just up the bluffs from the long-gone polo grounds, feels mostly unchanged even 50 years later. It was poorer then, sure, like the rest of New York City. In the age before earbuds and headphones, it was surely louder. You heard music in the streets. Outside Frankie's old address, on West 165th, there's a wet paint sign on the door that this bright autumn morning. In one building over, a crew is painting the ancient fire escapes. The whole block smells of solvent, sharp and clean. It's a well-kept street of 5- and 6-story apartment houses in a tidy neighborhood of working-class folks who greet each other on the sidewalk, black and white and brown, Latin American and Caribbean immigrants and Great Migration African Americans, and, like the rest of New York, folks from all over. Lyman spent years shuttling from house to house and couch to couch. By the mid-1960s, he'd been in and out of rehab and tried a couple of comebacks, but he was trapped at his own shadow, lip-syncing at age 23 songs he recorded 10 years before. Hollywood A Go-Go was his last TV appearance in 1965. Then he was drafted and sent south and was dishonorably discharged for being constantly AWOL. Young as he was, Lyman had 3 wives. He married them in quick succession, and there was plenty of confusion about the paperwork. He may have been married to more than one at a time, or not entirely married to one of the 3 at all. One of them may have been married to someone else. Depends whom you ask. In the 1980s, they all met in court to settle Lyman's estate, such as it was, to find out who was entitled to songwriting royalties from bestsellers like Why Do Fools Fall in Love? None got much, but the 3rd wife, Amira Eagle, received an undisclosed settlement from record producers. In 1966, there was a brief glimmer of hope. Fresh out of rehab at Manhattan General Hospital, Lyman appeared at a block party organized by a group of nuns at a Catholic settlement house in the Bronx. He told an audience of 2,000 teenagers, "I have been born again. I'm not ashamed to let the public know I took the cure. Maybe my story will keep some other kids from going wrong. On February 27, 1968, he was booked for a recording session to mark the start of a comeback. Instead, he was found dead that morning on his grandmother's bathroom floor. Frankie Lyman was buried in the Bronx at St. Raymond's Cemetery, Row 13, Grave 70. It's 15 minutes by car from the old neighborhood. His headstone is over by the highway. The grass is green and the ground is hard and uneven, and on the left, his stone is packed tight with the others. On the right, there's a gap like a missing tooth. You can see the towers of two bridges from here, the Bronx Whitestone and Throng's Neck, and hear the traffic rush past on the Cross Bronx Expressway. Billie Holiday is buried here, and Typhoid Mary. This is where the Lindbergh Ransom Exchange happened. The wind comes hard off East Chester Bay and shakes the pagoda trees. For years, Frankie's grave was unmarked. In the mid-1980s, a New Jersey music store held a benefit to raise money for a memorial, but it never made it to the cemetery. The headstone gathered dust in the record shop, then moved at last to the backyard of a friend of the owner. Amira Eagle had the current headstone installed sometime in the late 1990s. In loving memory of my husband, Frank J. Lyman, September 30th, 1942, to February 27th, 1968. Not much room to tell his story. And what could anyone say? That the 1950s were long over? That innocence was dead? That by 1968, one America had vanished entirely and another had taken its place? Or maybe that Frankie Lyman's America, doo-wop America, was never simple, never sweet, but rather an America as complex and racked by animus and desire as any in history. It was the same America that killed Emmett Till, after all, another angelfish-faced kid with apple cheeks and a wide, bright smile. Seen across the gulf of years, what we now think of as the anodyne, antiseptic 1950s America is revealed as an illusion. June Cleaver vacuuming in an organdy cocktail dress and pearls is a television mirage, a national hallucination. We held the post-war world economy to ourselves because so many other industrial nations had been bombed flat. And for every Pat Boone, there was a Howell, an Allen Ginsberg, a Kerouac, a Coltrane, a Krasner, a Ferlinghetti. There were underground explosions in painting and poetry and music and prose. It was a kind of invisible revolution. A telling detail of that chaste 1950s mythology. To preserve his image as a clean-cut teenager, Frankie Lyman would pass off the women he dated in different cities as his mother. It gets told and told and told. In fact, he told it himself, that he once got caught by a reporter who went to shows in New York and Chicago and saw that his mom was two different women, each twice Frankie's age. A story too good to fact-check. It was in these 1950s that Ralph Ellison wrote Invisible Man, and James Baldwin published Notes of a Native Son. After Rosa Parks was pulled off that bus, Dr. King led the Montgomery bus boycott and changed the trajectory of civil rights in America. The Supreme Court decided Brown versus Board of Education, and then came to Little Rock and the lunch counter sit-ins at Wichita and Oklahoma City. What you saw of the 50s in America was all about where you stood and with whom. Was the short, blinding arc of Frankie Lyman's career a morality play, a rock and roll cautionary tale, or just another story of a young man gone too soon? Maybe it was a reminder that America changes in every instant and never changes at all. Our streets have always been filled with music and temptation. Addiction has always been with us long before us was even America. From the lotus eaters of the Odyssey, to the opium dens of the Wild West, to the crack epidemic, and on to our own new opioid crisis. Looking at that headstone, you get to thinking maybe Frankie Lyman was the 1950s, man and myth, the junkie with an angel's voice, and that the stone stands as a monument to the lies we tell ourselves about America in the time before Frankie flew away. The very night Lyman died, Walter Cronkite went on air and said of Vietnam, "We are mired in a stalemate." It was clear the center couldn't hold, and if you felt like the 1950s were five polite young men in matching letter sweaters, the rest of 1968 came at you like the four horsemen of the apocalypse. The world lurched and suddenly spun too fast. Tet, My Lai, Chicago, Washington, Baltimore. Riots everywhere. Vietnam, the pulse and drumbeat behind and beneath everything. So when Frankie Lyman died that February morning, you'd have been forgiven for missing it. He was nearly forgotten by then. A five-paragraph item on page 50 of the New York Times. A casualty of the moment, the future, and the past came apart. It was sad, but for a while, arms wide and head back, Frankie Lyman had bridged and bound all those opposing energies. That face, that voice. Man, he could sing like an angel. Now we'll move on to an article titled Bobby's Kids by Jesse Katz. At the site where Robert Kennedy was killed, students at a Los Angeles public school keep his spirit alive. His fight may have been cut short before they were born, but he would have recognized the struggles they face. The children of janitors and gardeners, dishwashers and security guards, Mexican, Salvadorian, Korean, Filipino, their adolescent yearnings and hardships percolating through the most densely populated corner of Los Angeles. Shortly after midnight on June 5, 1968, when Senator Robert F. Kennedy delivered his final address, he was standing in their library, then the embassy ballroom of the Ambassador Hotel, celebrating his victory in California's Democratic primary and deploring the division, the violence, the disenchantment with our society. Moments later, exiting through the hotel pantry, Kennedy was assassinated by gunman Sirhan Sirhan. Today, more than 4,000 students inhabit those grounds, a campus of six learning centers, kindergarten through 12th grade, that operate as the Robert F. Kennedy Community Schools. In this era of historical reassessment, of reexamining the figures worthy of a pedestal, RFK seems an enduringly relevant namesake for a school serving the sons and daughters of Los Angeles' foreign-born working poor. A 40-foot-tall portrait of the slain presidential candidate, painted by Shepard Fairey, looms over a central courtyard. Other murals, plaques, and framed black-and-white photographs documenting the life and times of Robert Kennedy crowd the interior walls. A display case of campaign buttons, bearing the slogans Viva Kennedy and Kennedy is the Remedy, graces the foyer of the school's auditorium, once the site of the Ambassador Hotel's storied nightclub and celebrity watering hole, the Coconut Grove. Even the campus mascot, the Bobcats, is a nod to the liberal folk hero. I was reading up about him a few weeks ago, says 16-year-old Jocelyn Huembes, a junior at RFK's Ambassador School of Global Leadership. I read that he was really a social justice-y type of person, and that's kind of what I believe in. Although the tumult of the 1968 presidential race and the anguish of a second Kennedy assassination can seem impossibly distant to a teenager in 2018, the thread running from RFK's agenda to Jocelyn's hopes and challenges is not hard to untangle. Her mother, who is from El Salvador, works as an in-home caregiver for the elderly. Her father, a carpet installer from Nicaragua, was deported when she was a child. Two older brothers, caught up in gangs, have urged her not to repeat their mistakes. Jocelyn takes four AP classes, U.S. History, English, and Spanish, Environmental Science. Yet, because she and her mom share a studio apartment with another family, she does not have a bedroom or desk or even a lamp to herself. Sometimes I have to turn the lights out because they want to go to sleep, says Jocelyn, who dreams of becoming a pediatrician. So if I have a lot of homework that's really important, I go to the bathroom. I turn on the lights, close the door, and sit on the toilet. Once a playground for Hollywood royalty, as well as actual kings and queens and sultans from around the globe, the Ambassador, then owned by the J. Meyer Shine family, fell on hard times after RFK's murder, and in 1989 it closed, ending 68 years of pomp and hijinks. The Los Angeles Unified School District, in the grip of an overcrowding crisis, pondered buying the 23.5-acre site. But before the district could act, a developer from New York, Donald Trump, and his business partners purchased the land, L.A. is going to be very hot, he said in 1990, unveiling plans to build what would have been the nation's tallest skyscraper, a 125-story tower where the hotel once stood. Thus began a decade-long legal and public relations brawl. L.A. educators going up against the formidable American enthusiasm for real estate development, while a generation of neighborhood kids who had to slog across town to attend school waited on the sidelines. Seizing the property initially by eminent domain, the school district ultimately prevailed. Trump complained in a deposition that the LAUSD had grabbed the land as viciously as in Nazi Germany. There would be more litigation brought by preservationists seeking to combat the city's disposable approach to architecture, and even by the attorney for Sirhan Sirhan, long after his conviction. He wanted to perform acoustical tests on the spot where his client ambushed the senator. But the school district, which did not want a crime scene as the centerpiece of its new campus, razed much of the property, including that infamous pantry. "There could be no better memorial to my father than a living memorial that educates the children of this city," Max Kennedy said at a 2006 groundbreaking for what would become a $579 million project. So tightly packed are the surrounding neighborhoods of Koreatown and Pico Union that the student body, 94% Latino and Asian, is drawn from just 1.5 square miles. Some are English learners. Most qualify for free lunch. Nearly all who attend college will be the first in their family to do so. Sumaya Sabnam, an 11th grader whose mathematical ability and civic activism has already earned her a $20,000 college scholarship, walks to school wearing a hijab, doing her best to tune out the taunts occasionally hurled her way on the street. "Math makes me feel calm, like, okay, there's an answer to something," says Sumaya, whose father served as a top official for a national political party in their native Bangladesh, but here drives a taxi. Samantha Galindo's trip home often involves a detour through Beverly Hills, where her Mexican-born father works nights as a janitor, his third job of the day. "Part of the reason I do good in school is that I want to get him out of that life, and when he has to work multiple jobs, because it's starting to take a toll on him," says Samantha, who does her homework on a jolting metro bus, then cleans offices alongside her dad until 10 p.m. Every 6 months, Aaron Rodriguez shows up at school not knowing whether his mother will make it home from her check-ins with immigration and customs enforcement officials or be deported to Guatemala. "She'll tell me, 'Oh, I have court today. If anything happens, I love you,'" says Aaron, a 17-year-old artist and animator. He once poured his feelings into a colored pencil sketch of a blazing sun trapped behind a barred window. Aaron finds special meaning in another RFK mural, completed by the artist Judy Baca in 2010, that runs 55 feet across the library wall, just above the spot where Kennedy delivered the last victory speech. "The image that stays with him," says Aaron, "is that of RFK standing over a crowd of people, and all of them are reaching toward him, and they're all different skin tones." Now we'll move on to Ask Smithsonian, your questions answered by our experts. Can all living things, plant, insects, and bacteria be albino? Liliana Hitchcock, Houston, Texas. If by albino you mean an organism lacking the pigment melanin, then loosely speaking, yes, says Carrie Mullitz-Wolz, a research scientist at Smithsonian Center for Conservation Genomics. Albinism, which is caused by a hereditary genetic mutation, is noticeable among mammals because melanin is the only pigment they produce. Without it, their hair, skin, and eyes will lack color. But other life forms produce a variety of pigments in addition to melanin. Some specimens may be unable to produce melanin, but their other pigments will show and may appear more properly called amelanistic. In either case, an organism lacking melanin will be more susceptible to ultraviolet rays. Why don't they use artificial gravity on the International Space Station? Pat Anderson, Shasta Lake, California. Creating artificial gravity on the space station is possible, but impractical, says Valerie Neal, a curator at the National Air and Space Museum's Space History Department. So to simulate gravity, you need to spin the station to produce a force that propels the astronauts outward. The force would enable them to walk on the walls. But keep in mind that the ISS is about the size of a football field, with solar panels and other delicate offshoots. Getting it to rotate and keeping the rate of rotation constant just isn't feasible. What happened to the rats that carried the fleas that carried the Black Death? Joan J. Brown, Fairfax, Virginia. Many of them died. The bacterium believed to have caused that fearsome pandemic, Yersinia pestis, infects rodents as well as humans, notes Callie Holder, veterinary pathology fellow at the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute. Historical evidence indicates that the black rat, Rattus rattus, was more vulnerable than the brown rat, Rattus norvegicus. Black rats have traditionally taken the blame for spreading the Black Death in Europe. Recent research, however, suggests that a more complicated interplay of disease vectors and environmental factors led to a Black Death successive waves plague that killed scores of millions of people in 14th century Europe and Asia. Could Neanderthals talk? If so, what was their language like? Rob Lowridge, Honolulu, Hawaii. We can be confident that Neanderthals could communicate vocally, says Rick Potts, director of the Human Origins Program at the National Museum of Natural History. All primates, our closest biological relatives, do. Unfortunately, words and grammar do not fossilize, so we can't tell much about what they said. Differences between human and Neanderthal skulls suggest that the human larynx, or voice box, extends deeper into the throat, and it allows our lower larynx that allows us to produce the miraculous diversity of consonants, vowels, clicks, and other sounds that can make up human speech. So it's unlikely that Neanderthals spoke like us. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.